Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Bechukotai. It's not too late to join us in Israel this summer at Pardes. It will be a summer you'll never forget. There's both a three-week program and also the one-week executive seminar. Find out more by Googling for Pardes Summer. I hope you can make it. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel discusses Bechukotai. Rabbi Alex Israel is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. This week, we read the parsha of Bechukotai. And this is a formidable parsha indeed. It details the blessings and the curses, the wonderful bounty that God will give the Jewish people if they follow the laws of the Torah, and the terrible devastation, the frightening curses, exile, rack, and ruin if the Jewish people abandon the covenant. I'll read a few examples. Im bechukotai telechu v'im mitzvotai tishmeru v'asitem otam. If you follow my laws and faithfully observe my commandments, I will grant you the rains in their season. The earth will yield its produce, the trees of the field their fruit. I will grant peace in the land. You shall lie down untroubled by anyone. I will give the land respite from vicious beasts, and the sword shall not cross your land. I will look with favor upon you and make you fertile and multiply you. I will establish my abode in your midst. I will be ever present in your midst. I will be your God. You will be my people. This is a language of national prosperity, economic boom, of peace and tranquility, and of spiritual togetherness with God. However, im lo tishmu li velo tasu et kol mitzvot ha'eleh, if you do not obey me, and if you do not observe all these commandments, if you reject my laws and spurn my rules, then I will wreak misery upon you, consumption and fever. I will set my face against you. You shall be routed by your enemies. Your foes shall dominate you. You shall flee, even though none pursues you. I will break your proud glory. I will make your skies like iron and your earth like copper. And he continues to say, I will loose wild beasts against you, shall bereave you of your children. And worse than that, I will bring a sword against you, wreak vengeance for your covenant. I will lay your cities in ruin, make your sanctuaries desolate. I will make the land desolate, so your enemies who settle on it shall be appalled by it. The land shall become a desolation and your cities a ruin. So this is a parsha of extremes. It is extreme. On the one hand, the most wonderful blessings and the most fantastic vision of national success and togetherness with God. On the other hand, the most awful images of devastation. Indeed, the curses, if you go to Shul on Shabbat and you hear the way that this parsha is read, it's known as the tochacha, the rebuke. In fact, we read it, says Maimonides, before the Shavuot, before the acceptance of the law, so that we understand the terms of conditions. We understand that there are certain rules and regulations which apply to the law. It's to put a bit of fear into our hearts. The Baal Korei, the Torah reader, usually lowers the tone of his singing, lowers his voice to a quieter tone, as if to say, well, we'll read this, but hopefully such things should never happen. Unfortunately, anybody who knows Jewish history knows that these things did happen, they have transpired. Nachmanides, in its introduction to Parshat Bahar, says that, in fact, Hashem did not intend to give such harsh warnings or such hard chastisement to the people. He didn't want to scare us when we received the Torah, but after we had performed the great sin of the golden calf, when God renewed the covenant and he gave the second tablets of stone, he thought that since we'd already sinned once, we should have appropriate warning. And therefore, if you want, he upped the volume. He raised our attention to the possibility of exile, for the possibility of national collapse as a result of abandoning the covenant. And he wanted the penalties for non-observance to be as clear. And in fact, when you look at the length of the descriptions here, the blessings cover about 8 verses, but the curses cover about three or four times that length. So God is definitely giving us a stern warning here about what can happen if us as a nation do not follow our legacy, do not follow our covenant, do not live up to our tradition. Okay, well, I don't really want to depress everybody and focus on only the negative in the parasha. So I'm going to try and take a certain angle in understanding this text. And I'm going to start with a interesting comment on Rashi, which Rashi makes on verse 32. Let me just read the verses here. I'll start from verse 31. I will spurn you, I will lay your cities in ruin and make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not savor your pleasing sacrifices. V'natati et arechem chorva, v'hashimoti et mikdasheichem, v'lo ariach poreach nichochachem. Verse 32, v'hashimoti ani et haaretz, I will make the land desolate, v'shamamu aleo oveichem. In English here in the JPS it says, so your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled. But if you read the Hebrew, v'shamamu alecha oivechem means, and your enemies shall be desolate on it, hayoshvimba, when they live in it. It continues, and I will spread you, scatter you amongst the nations, and unsheath the sword against you. And repeats again, your land shall become a desolation. V'hayta artzechem shmama v'arechem yuchorba. Three times it mentions that your cities will be ruined, your land will be desolate. Why does this need to be mentioned three times? Moreover, it says, I will destroy the land, and your enemies will be desolate when they live on it. Rashi makes a fascinating comment here. Rashi says, V'hashimoti ani et haaretz, I will destroy the land, zu midah tova liYisrael. You might think this is a bad thing, this is a good sign to Israel. That your enemies, that no other nation, will find any sort of satisfaction in your land. That the land will be desolate from its inhabitants. What Rashi's claiming is that when the land is desolate because of the Jews, when the Israelites, or when Am Yisrael have been punished, and that we are exiled from the land, it's not like the land will become prosperous, become green and fertile for any other nation. No. Rashi says that, in fact, the land will only become fertile and lush for the Jewish people. And when it becomes desolate for us, it won't give up its bounty for other people. It will not flower and bloom for any other nation. This, in some way, is a backhanded blessing. Because if we shouldn't have the land, well, at least nobody else should. The land, according to Rashi, retains a loyalty to the Jewish people. Now, this is a remarkable thing, because how can a land retain loyalty? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Of course, we're dealing here with earth and rocks, mountains, hills and valleys and streams. They're inanimate. They don't have allegiances. It seems absolutely preposterous, illogical, for the land of Israel only to flower and bloom for the Jewish people. And yet, this is what Rashi's saying, and dare I say, that this, once again, history has borne this out. Many of you might have read the famous passage from Mark Twain, in which he describes the desolation of the Holy Land just 150 years ago, before the first settlers of Zionism came along. And indeed, it is not only Mark Twain. My father collects old books of travelers who came to Israel throughout the centuries. The earliest books he has are from the 17th century, and devout Christian travelers who also had the means would travel through the Holy Land from Egypt all the way up to Syria and see all the places from the Bible. And they all describe the fact that the land has been stripped of all its greenery, the forestation, the agriculture, that the Holy Land was simply a terribly desert-like environment. And we all know that's part of the mission that Ben-Gurion set himself with the restoration of Zionism and in general the Zionist enterprise was to work on agriculture. The first agricultural school, Mikveh Yisrael, in 1870. Later on, the idea of making the desert bloom. And indeed, we have succeeded in turning this very arid land into a powerhouse of agriculture and water conservation. Okay, enough of the Zionist propaganda at this point, but I want to come back to our learning. Rashi's saying that there is a very deep connection between the land and the people. It's almost as if the land is animate. The land has its own character. It has its personality. And I was thinking about this and was wondering whether we see that in any other places. And in fact, I think we do. Let me give you another example from later on in the parasha. The parasha says that when the land is ruined, and here I'm reading from verse 34, then the land shall make up for its Sabbath years throughout the time that it is desolate, and you are in the land of your enemies. Then the land shall rest and make up for its Sabbath years. Throughout the time that it is desolate, it shall observe the rest that it did not observe in the Sabbath years while you were dwelling upon it. What verse 34 and 35, which I just read, are suggesting is that when Israel did not keep the sabbatical years, the years in which the land is meant to rest, well, the land had to work during those years. So it sort of accrues a certain debt. And when the land becomes desolate, all those years that Israel leaves the land, suddenly the land will now have a chance to relax, to rest, to take back those years. What is this idea that the land sort of is owed years of rest? Where does that come from? But this is not the only place in which the land appears to have a personality. A land appears to act in an active rather than a passive form. The land seems to have certain allegiances. And again, this is somewhat unusual. I'd like to turn back to an earlier parasha, Parashat Acharei Mot, chapter 18. Because chapter 18 talks about how you're coming to the land and you have to observe a certain moral code. There it's talking about sexual standards, not to be promiscuous, and not to have sort of immorality and incest. And at the end of the whole list of all the forbidden sexual relationships there, I'd like to read the following segment. It's in Vayikra, Leviticus chapter 18. Verse 24, 25, etc. Do not defile yourself in any of these ways, for it is by such that the nations that I am casting out before you defiled themselves. Thus the land became defiled, and I called it to account for its iniquity, and the land spewed out, vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my laws and my rules. You must not do any of these abhorrent things, neither the citizen nor the stranger who resides amongst you, so that the land not spew you out for defiling it as it spewed out the nations that came before you. What exactly are we saying here? We're saying that, I mean, this sort of metaphor which the Torah is using of a land which vomits out its inhabitants. This is a country with a sensitive stomach. This is a country whose stomach is sensitive to what? To moral failings. And if we fail morally, the land will simply not tolerate us, like as if we eat some food which is in some way spoiled. If we act in a spoiled way, the land will simply vomit us out. It will not be able to tolerate such sinning on its soil. It's not only in the book of Vayikra that we find this idea of the land sort of having its own personality. If you look in the book of Bamidbar, where it talks not about sexual impropriety, but rather it talks about murder. In the story of the refuge cities, Bamidbar, Numbers chapter 35, it talks about the notion of murder in the Holy Land, murder in the land of Israel. What happens if there is an environment of murder? And I would once again like to read a few psukim there. It says, "You may never accept a ransom instead of a flight to the city of refuge." In other words, you are not allowed to have somebody pay you off because they murdered somebody. And then it continues, and you shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land. And the land can have no expiation for blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in which I myself abide, for the Lord abides among the Israelite people. Once again, on the one hand, the idea is that God abides here, and God does not tolerate murder. But on the other hand, the way it's phrased is that the land will not tolerate murder. And I find this like quite a fascinating image, the idea that the land seems to care. Now, I do think this goes exceptionally deep. I think this does reverberate with a certain Zionist overtones, and with this I will plead guilty. But I think it goes even to a more fundamental place in the Torah, and that is back to the Garden of Eden. And what do I mean by going back to the Garden of Eden? The Torah begins with describing the birth of Adam. And Adam, the first human being, and maybe a paradigm of all humans, maybe he's designed to be that way. Interestingly enough, the way Adam, and that's his name, is created, is from Adama. We have the idea of Vayitzar Hashem Elokim et Adam, afar min ha'adama. Man is created, his name is Adam, because he's from Adama. There is a connection between man and earth. It's a very deep connection. It's a deep connection in the sense that the minute that man sins, it's not only man who is punished, but he's punished with a certain alienation between himself and between the earth. How does this manifest itself? If you recall, he says, to Adam he said, because you did as your wife said, and you ate from the tree about which I command you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed be the ground because of you. Arura ha'adama ba'avurecha. I don't understand. On the one hand, Adam should be cursed. Why is the Adama cursed? Why is the ground cursed? Thorns and thistles shall sprout for you, but your food shall be the grasses of the field. Okay? So now, by the sweat of your brow you shall get bread to eat until you return to the ground. This idea of the ground. Bezeat apecha tocha lechem, you will eat the sweat of your brow until you return to the earth where you were taken from, because you are dust and you will return to dust. There's almost a betrayal of man's origins. If man betrays his legacy, if he betrays his relationship with God, his covenant with God, his laws with God, the land won't work for him in the same way. I still remember many, many years ago when I was my children were little, and I was digging once in the garden, digging up the garden, and I was sweating. And one of my children came to me and said, I know why you're sweating. And I said, yes, because I'm working hard. And they said, no, because Adam ate the apple. You are sweating because of him, because it says, by the sweat of thy brow. This continues, by the way, in Sefer Bereishit. If you recall the story of Cain, once again, the first murder, it talks about the idea that kol demei achicha soakim elai min adama, the sound of the blood of your brother, cry to me from the earth, the adama. And once again he says, Va'ata arur ata min ha'adama. Cain is cursed from the soil, from the earth, which took the blood of your brother. And now he continues and says, you will till the soil, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. You shall become a ceaseless wanderer in the world. Ki ta'avodet adama lotosef te kocha. In other words, as Adam sins, he is alienated from adama. As Cain sins even more, he is alienated even more. Now, not only does he have to work, but he has to wander. It's almost as if the land will not accept him anywhere. Adam has ripped himself away from the Adama. This reaches its crescendo in the flood, where in the flood, once again, what we're told here is after man has sinned, we're told that it's not only the man who has sinned, but God says, Emche ta Adam asher barati, I will blot out from the earth the men who I created. Emche ta Adam asher barati me'al pnei ha'adama. And there is even, from the Adama, there is even an idea that when man was blotted out from the earth, when man was destroyed in the flood, not only was man destroyed, but the topsoil of the earth washed away and was never more to be found. Why should man and soil be connected? Because man and soil are really one and the same. There is this very primal relationship between man and soil. Now, when we think about this message, we can come up with a very ecological take-home message, which is that man and our very environment, the earth itself, and human beings have this sort of mystical connection, which goes back to the creation of Adam from Adama, and which in some way is reflected in the land of Israel. And that's certainly the way that the Torah wishes to see it, maybe not only with the ecological overtones, but with spiritual overtones. Human beings have a connection with earth, Maybe this was disrupted, put on hold, after the expulsion from the Garden of Eden and certainly after the flood. But in the land of Israel, that relationship is renewed, that the land is spiritually sensitive, that the nation and the land in some way are one. Where do I see that? Well, one place I see it is in the second paragraph of the Shema. The second paragraph of the Shema, which we know, it's in Devarim, Deuteronomy. You can find it here in chapter 11, and it says that if you serve other gods, Vatzaret HaShemayim, the heavens will be stopped up. And it says there, V'ha'adama lo titen et yivula. The Adama, once again, the land will not give its produce. There seems to be a very intimate relationship between, if you want, we've come back to the Garden of Eden metaphors. And this is amplified once again by a comment of Rashi, if I come back to Bechukotai. When they give all of these wonderful blessings, it tells us that God will make us fertile and the agriculture will bloom. One of the blessings is that God says, V'hitalachti betochachem, I will walk amongst you, and I will be your God. V'hiti lachem l'Elohim. And if you look at Rashi, Rashi there says, again, a mysterious comment, I will walk amongst you, atayel imachem began Eden ke'echad mikem. I will walk amongst you, like I did in the Garden of Eden, v'lotu mizdaza'im mimenu, you will not quake from me. Rashi here is resting on a biblical parallel, because it says in the Garden of Eden in chapter 3 that the Spirit of God, Mihaya mithalech betoch hagan, it was walking in the garden. What Rashi is saying at some level is that the land of Israel, if we keep the laws or if we don't keep the laws, Israel and the land of Israel in some way has certain of the properties of the Garden of Eden. God is more manifest. The land itself, the ecology, is more sensitive to our sins, to our moral misdemeanors, to our ethical failings. And therefore we have to be extra specially sensitive when we are in our land, as our own nation, because God is holding us to a higher standard. If you want, the spiritual potential is higher, but the moral failings are treated with greater severity. Even though we don't live in messianic times, even though we live in normal times, but we are, and as I record this from Jerusalem, and this certainly inspires me, but also haunts me a little bit. The fact that the way that the Torah describes Israel and its land is sort of on a paradigm of a very deep connectedness between nation and land, a very deep connectedness that the land will be responsive if we stain it with sin, that God here has a greater sense of being present, but that the penalties for moral failings are far more problematic. I think I'm going to end off with a story, because we all love stories. And this is a story I heard some years ago from Rabbi Riskin. Rabbi Riskin told an amazing story about somebody called Yaakov Chazan, who was a leader of the socialist movement here in Israel. Yaakov Chazan came from the city of Brisk. Brisk in, I don't know, Lithuania, I think it is. Yaakov Chazan was the son of the local dayan, the local judge. But as a child, he had a problem. And that is, he had a medical problem. He was severely asthmatic. And they went to a doctor in Warsaw, him and his father. His father was a very respected judge, Jewish judge in the community, a very pious man and scholar. And they went to a doctor specialist, a lung specialist in Warsaw. And he saw him and he said, well, your son is really malnourished and he has to get out into the country. In fact, he says he really needs to do two things. Number one, he needs to fatten himself up, and the best way to do that is to eat pig's meat. Well, that was the recommendation, to eat pig, and he needs to go out and work in the country, go out to work in the fields. Well, the first was not an option. He wasn't not going to eat kosher, but his father decided that he would send him out somewhere outside Brisk to live with a Polish peasant for a while in order to help him get a bit more healthy and to get over his asthma. So told Yaakov Chazan. Now, where does the story begin? So Yaakov Chazan says that he was day by day working with this Polish farmer. The Polish farmer would always be singing. He once turned round to the farmer. He was a little boy. He was 10 or 11. And he said to him, why are you always singing? Why do you always, as you're working, you're singing along all the time? The man said, well, I'm singing the song of the land. So the little Yaakov says, but I don't hear any song. Polish farmer says to him, bend down, Yaakov, bend down and listen to the song of the land. He puts his ear to the ground and he says, can't hear a thing. Puts his ear again, he can't hear a thing. He turns around to the farmer, the non-Jewish farmer, and he says to him, the Polish farmer, he says, I can't hear the song. The Polish farmer turns around to him and says, Yaakov, you know why you can't hear the song of the land? Because it's not your land. It's Polish soil, and you are a Jew. Because you were a Jew, you can't hear the song of Poland. Yaakov Chazan says that that was the moment when he decided that he had to come to the land of Israel. That was the moment when he had to come to his land, because only in his land he would be able to hear that song. The Jewish people have a unique connection to the land of Israel. In the land of Israel, we can be more connected in many, many different dimensions. We can be more connected to the song of the land. And that song of the land is a fusion both of the Adam and the Adama, of morality, of covenant, and of God. We should hope and pray to God that we are worthy, we're worthy of that covenant, we're worthy of the land, and that we are able to live up to the covenant of God, to his high moral standards in this special place. Wishing you all Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.